of difference. You're with NITV Radio on mobile, online, and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandami. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 6th of May. Well, like every Monday, we'll bring you current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective brought to us by NITV's NOLA program. Also, leading up to the premiere of Season 2 of Our Law later this week, we caught up with Acting Sergeant Patricia Pedro, one of the officers whose journey as a First Nations woman and police officer is told in the NITV SBS observational documentary series. And leading up to the Paris Olympics, the Australian Olympic Committee has announced a new funding scheme, the Australian Olympic Indigenous Athlete Fund, that they hope will support more First Nations competitors to get to future games and succeed. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The Native Title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, Victorian Premier told to live up to her words at truth-telling inquiry. A $230 million domestic violence prevention and support package for New South Wales. And Israel orders Al Jazeera to close its local operation. Victorian Premier Jacinta Allan last week became the first head of government to appear before an Indigenous truth-telling inquiry in Australia. The Premier spoke at the Yurok Justice Commission, which is investigating injustices related to lands, skies and waters. Jacinta Allan was ashamed at how little she knew of the massacres of First Nations people on Jajawarong country in central Victoria.
I want to acknowledge there is an unbroken line between the dispossession and violence of the past and the lives of First Peoples today.
The Commission urged her to act on her words.
We must move beyond words. We do not want to be talking about failure of this Commission in 30 years' time.
The French Embassy in Canberra has held a welcome to country ceremony for the first time. The Ambassador of France to Australia, Mr. Pierre-André Imbert, said that France is dedicated to continue reinforcing its relationships with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people through shared history and memory.
Based on all this history, we want to have more cultural exchanges. And that's why we have the new French-Australian Foundation for Cultural Exchanges.
The historic welcome was performed by Ngambri Ngunnawal artist Paul Kirawa House and included a smoking ceremony outside the embassy. Traditional tree carvings that would be housed inside the embassy were also unveiled. As part of the cultural exchange, Mr. House will travel to Paris later this year to install similar sculptures in the Quai Branly Museum.
Cultural exchange is very important, and to be able to share our story and connection to the country with the people of France and gift our culture and heritage and, you know, reciprocate.
Bay law reform, homelessness prevention programs and greater support for victim survivors are key initiatives in a new South Wales $230 million domestic violence prevention and support package. Domestic violence is preventable and there needs to be a greater focus on disrupting the cycle of abuse early, says Premier Chris Minns as he unveiled details of the four-year funding plan today.
So today the government's announcing a $230 million package for domestic
family and sexual violence in our community. But I need to say that this is not a day of joy or boasting from the New South Wales government. This package is being demanded by the victims and survivors of domestic, family and sexual violence in New South Wales. It's a recognition that the state needs to do more and that something needs to change. I'm truly sorry that these reforms are being announced today and not earlier than today. And the bottom line here is that all governments need to do better.
The emergency package was promised after New South Wales Cabinet met last week to hear from experts in the field. More than $73 million will go towards reforming the New South Wales justice system to help victims, including $45 million set aside to improve bail laws and other systemic responses, to be detailed in coming weeks. Australians studying teaching, nursing, midwifery or social work could be paid nearly $320 per week during their work placements in a federal government effort to alleviate cost of living pressures. As part of their degrees, teaching students are required to undertake about 600 hours of placement, while aspiring nurses have to do about 800 hours, forcing many to give up part-time jobs for unpaid labour. But from July 2025, about 68,000 university students and 5,000 vocational education and training students will be eligible for $319 payment each week, in addition to income support they may already receive as part of the federal government's budget in mid-May. Education Minister Jason Clare says the paid placements are aimed at easing workforce shortages in the care and education sectors, and the government could expand these to other industries later down the line. And more than 3 million Australians will have an average of $1,200 of their student debt wiped under a federal plan to reform the way loans are indexed. Education Minister Jason Clare has announced the government would cap the higher education loan program indexation rate, eliminating about $3 billion of student debt. The capped rate, which will form part of this month's federal budget, will ensure indexation matched whichever of the consumer price index or wage price index is lower. And the Minister for Education also says he doesn't want to see violence spread on Australian university campuses, warning pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel protesters to lower the temperature. Protesters condemning Israel's seven-month assault on Gaza have been camping at universities across Australia, most prominently at the University of Sydney and University of Melbourne, where they have been met with counter-protests. Education Minister Jason Clare says nothing is more important than the safety of students.
That's why I stress the point, Matt. We've just got to lower the temperature here. There's always a right to protest in a democratic nation like Australia, but there's no place for fear and intimidation and hate or anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, and there is a role to play for all of us here. The politicians, the media, religious leaders, community leaders here, to work together here to keep our country together, not let it get torn apart.
His comments follow chaotic scenes at universities in the United States, where police have been called in to forcibly dismantle pro-Palestinian encampments and arrest scores of students. Israeli police have raided a Jerusalem hotel room used by Al Jazeera as its de facto office following a government decision to shut down the Qatari-owned TV station's local operations. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the network would be shut down for as long as the war in Gaza continues on the grounds it threatens national security. It allows Mr. Netanyahu to shut the network's office in Israel for 45 days, but that period can be renewed.
After a discussion at the security cabinet and following my directive, the government will discuss the closing of Al Jazeera broadcasts in Israel. Al Jazeera reporters harmed Israel's security and incited against IDF soldiers. It is time to remove the Hamas mouthpiece from our country.
The order, which includes confiscating broadcast equipment, preventing the broadcast of the channel's reports and blocking its websites, is believed to be the first time Israel has ever closed a foreign news outlet operating in the country. Al Jazeera has labeled the move a criminal action and has rejected an accusation the network threatened Israel's security, describing the accusation as a dangerous and ridiculous lie which puts its journalists at risk. In the meantime, negotiations in Cairo to reach a deal to bring an end to the nearly seven-month-long war in Gaza are ongoing. Egyptian and U.S. mediators have reported recent signs of compromise, but Israel's prime minister has cast doubt on its accepting an end to the war without reaching its stated goal of eradicating Hamas. And back home, Qantas has admitted it misled thousands of customers over flight cancellations for years and will now pay $120 million in fines and compensation. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission had sued the airline in the federal court after alleging Qantas engaged in false, misleading or deceptive conduct by continuing to sell the tickets. The competition watchdog says the parties had agreed to ask the court to impose a $100 million penalty after Qantas admitted the conduct went on for a year longer than the ACCC alleged. Payments to 86,497 customers who, between May 2021 and August 2023, were sold tickets Qantas had already decided to cancel, will share in about $20 million in compensation. Qantas will pay $225 to domestic customers and $450 to international customers. And now to sport. The Australian Olympic Committee says it is committing to more investment in First Nations athletes ahead of the 2024 Paris Olympic Games. President of the Australian Olympic Committee, Ian Chesterman, made the announcement following an annual general meeting. Mr. Chesterman says they are incredibly excited about the future of the Games.
We're really delighted to announce today that a grant we made to every Indigenous athlete in the team for Paris who meets the criteria set down by our own Indigenous Advisory Committee. That's a $5,000 grant, and we're hoping that at least 10 athletes will take advantage of that, and hopefully a whole lot more if they get to be on the team in Paris.
And now having a look at the weather around the country, Broome, sunny 34, Perth, mostly sunny 21, Adelaide, similar conditions 22, Melbourne, cloud clearing 20, Hobart, partly cloudy 17, Albury, Wodonga, sunny 21, Canberra, partly cloudy 17, Wollongong, showers 20, Sydney, much the same 22, Newcastle, rain easing 23, Brisbane, mostly sunny 25, Townsville, similar forecast 29, Cairns, possible shower 29, Alice Springs, partly cloudy 22, Darwin mostly sunny 33, and the Torres Strait Islands partly cloudy day ahead and a top of 31 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame, and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from NAM this Monday afternoon. Now, coming up next, we have a conversation with Acting Sergeant Patricia Pedro, who is working on Thursday Island as a police officer. She's one of the officers whose journeys are told in Aolo, an observational documentary series that offers a rare glimpse into the lives of First Nations police officers as they navigate the complexities of policing in Indigenous communities around Australia. And the Australian Olympic Committee has announced increased funding for First Nations athletes as part of a new funding initiative for all athletes leading up to the Paris Olympics. The fund seeks to see more First Nations athletes competing in future Olympics. But first, current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective brought to us by NITV's NOLA program.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Well, 30 years ago, there were no homegrown doctors in the Torres Strait region. Now, the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association has taken a group of 20 Torres Strait Islander doctors from the mainland to the islands for the first time. As Carly Willis reports, it comes as elders call for better access to healthcare across the islands.
For many of these students and doctors, it's the first time they've been on country, in their homelands in the Torres Strait. They're hearing firsthand from elders about remote health experiences.
It's been a very emotional, like, I've been very excited, but just to see how many Torres Strait Islander doctors and other medical students there is, and it's very special and very important significantly because there was the call from the community to have people come back.
Today, there are 127 Torres Strait Islander doctors across Australia of 130,000 total doctors.
What AAU to do really well is discuss cultural safety in the healthcare system, because we know that if the healthcare system isn't safe, Indigenous medical workforce won't work there.
The organisation says it's now working with Queensland Health to roll out training on culturally safe practice.
So we're really trying to actively work with them to understand cultural safety, and they are they're really engaging in that.
It comes as elders in the community call for better health access in the Torres Strait.
We in 21st century, we're not in third world country. Australia should look more to remote communities, remote places. When you leave your country, you leave your home, your family go with you, everything's down. Our cultural protocols, everything's met.
Doctors say a federal government funding program falls short of what's needed for infrastructure for remote island dialysis units.
We have an abundance of salt water in our saltwater country, but being able to make sure that there's a right amount of water and quality water for dialysis treatment needs without infringing on just general community water needs, that's really important.
The Federal Assistant Minister for Indigenous Affairs flew to Wyben to hear the concerns. She says the government will commit 4 dialysis chairs to a facility on Bardu if there is water security.
For Torres Strait Islanders, there are just way too many who are needing to leave their communities to access dialysis, and I'm hoping we can make that a little bit better for them.
Keeping our elders in care on country. Carly Willis, NITV News.
And last week, traditional owners from the Torres Strait were in Gimai for final submissions in a landmark environment court case. 2 elders are suing the Commonwealth in the federal court for failing to protect their island homes from climate change. Dan Rennie reports.
These Torres Strait Islanders are dancing outside the court, where their elders are suing the Commonwealth government over climate change.
It's time now to change. Otherwise, my good family, it'll be too late. If government will hear our voice, then we will survive. If government won't listen to us, we will be a climate change refugees in our own islands. Thank you.
The federal court case was launched in October 2021. It's included on-country hearings on Bardu, Boigu and Saibai Islands in the Torres Strait.
Now we're coming to the closing argument as we're standing here on our journey for 4 years, battling for our own community, to the Torres Strait, for the people, to our land, future and the generation.
This is the most consequential piece of climate litigation to ever take place in Australian history, and one of the most globally significant climate change cases to ever happen.
The elders' lawyers say the federal government is failing to protect ancient Indigenous culture in the Torres Strait from climate change. There are more than 200 islands in the Torres Strait, stretching between Cape York and Papua New Guinea. Some are just a metre above sea level.
Where we're from, this is a cry for many, many, many years. The survival of our people on Saibai and Boigu that has been forgotten for many years. Well, we are just on the doorstep of this country that have a duty of care from federal government. Where is it?
My island home, my island home, my island home is waiting for me.
Christine Arnoux, lending her voice to the climate case. The musician's mother was born on Saibai Island.
I'm looking after my mum these days,
And I think about that really horrible time in the future when the pain of losing my mother, because once you lose your mother, you've lost her, Embigor. And I think about losing our motherland and the same pain that we would feel to lose her as well.
Torres Strait Islanders hope their legal action will force the federal government to reduce pollution enough to save their homeland from climate change. Dan Rennie, NITV News.
Now, a new local decision-making agreement has been signed between the Arnhem Land Progress Aboriginal Corporation and the Northern Territory government. NITV correspondent Emma Kellaway travelled to the Northeast Arnhem Land community of Kapuyak, where community leaders met with stakeholders to formalise the commitment.
Yolngu Youth front and centre. The Kapuyak community coming together to deliver a joint agreement they hope will see better outcomes for their young people.
Today is the special day to say we are going to continue that journey for the Jamakuli with that East Arnhem Land Youth Model. And we now have some Yindi Rupiah as well.
A $7.7 million commitment to local decision-making by territory and federal governments set to fund the expansion of a youth program that looks to engage young people in locally run activities.
It gives us that financial backing and allows us to make plans for 3.5 years rather than a year at a time, hoping that we've got enough money to run it.
From talent shows to cultural workshops, local leaders say so far the program has helped grow strong connections to culture and family.
We don't want them to go to prison or Dundale or rehab or welfare. That's why we to work as Yolngu to Yolngu, working together.
We're passing, teaching our young people to come strong.
The East Arnhem Land Youth Model joins a growing list of local decision-making agreements made in communities across the Top End, with hopes the model could soon be expanded to other states and territories.
We tried to do that with the referendum last year. We were unsuccessful, and we still believe as a federal Labor government that First Nations people at every level still need to lead the way.
Finding ways of working together to strengthen the next generation. Emma Kellaway, NITV News.
And that's all for the story shared with us by Nola, NITV's program focusing on current affairs from a First Nations perspective. Time for a break and a truck. When we come back, conversation with Acting Sergeant Patricia Pedro, a First Nations police officer working on Thursday Island.
Hi, you're listening to the radio of NITV.
Coming up next on NITV Radio, the story of Acting Sergeant Patricia Pedro. You'll hear that together with other Indigenous uniformed and non-uniformed officers, they serve as role models, bridging the gap in policing.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
The much-anticipated second installment of the powerful observational documentary series Our Law, which explores the relationship between police and First Nations peoples, will premiere on NITV and SBS on Thursday, the 9th of May at 8:30 p.m. This 8-part docu-series continues to break new ground, privy to frontline police operations, squad car conversations, high-stakes decision-making, and the powerful personal journeys of First Nations police officers and recruits around Australia. Joining me to give us some insights into the documentary and its significance is one of the officers featured in the series, Acting Sergeant Patricia Pedro, based on Thursday Island. Sergeant Patricia Pedro, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, all the way from the Torres Strait. I'm looking forward to the series airing on the 9th of May.
Can you tell us about your background and what inspired you to join the police force?
I'm a proud First Nations woman, so I'm Aboriginal descent. So my mob is from far north Queensland, from Townsville, Burdekin area. So Bindal, Wakaroo, our tribe, so which is my great-grandmother's tribe. They were taken from their tribal lands up north and they were dumped in Sherbet as part of colonisation took place. They lived under the Aboriginal Protection Act. So that's why my family, how my family ended up in Sherbury. What inspired me to join the police? When I was in high school, I had the opportunity to go to Brisbane. We went to all the universities and we went to the police academy. This is where the seed was planted for me. As we all know, the relationships between police and First Nations people is volatile to this day. A lot of our people don't really like police. And I thought this particular profession, wearing the uniform, being a position of authority, I thought to myself, as an Aboriginal person, this would make people see me differently, I suppose, and be on the same level as a non-Indigenous person. So this is how I saw myself and what sort of motivated me to join. So I went to the police academy. I seen all these white police wearing uniforms, and I thought to myself, yeah, that's what I want to be, and that's what I went on to do.
So you work on country, and how do you approach policing in First Nations communities differently compared to non-Indigenous communities?
Well, it's very different. Policing in a community is very different from obviously policing in Brisbane. Obviously, I lived and worked in the Torres Strait based on Thursday Island since 2010. So in community, obviously, you live in community, you build relationships, you build a rapport with the people, you have to live amongst the community. So it is a very different style of policing. So you have to really work with the community, and it's about being proactive and reactive. If I can say that, it's about working with other government departments, NGOs. It is about working with the people, grassroots level people, like my people. Whereas in Brisbane, you can do that to some extent, but you know, you can really work in one division and live in another. You're not really part of the community. Obviously, Brisbane is a big urban area. It is very rewarding and satisfying policing my own people in a small community like Thursday Island and servicing the Outer Island.
Now, the documentary Our Law highlighted the importance of community engagement in policing. Can you share with us some of your experiences building trust and relationships with Indigenous communities?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that I helped to implement in the community up here was so I identified like there was a lack of education around domestic violence and most recently about coercive control. So I had an idea of having a cultural way of exchanging knowledge to young circles with our people up here. And so I proposed this idea to the OIC at the Island, and we went out and we did young circles on the Outer Island. We work collaboratively with Queensland Health, Mora Cross Gear, which is another women's organisation, and other government departments and organisations jumped on board as well. And we service the Outer Islands, and we conducted these yarning circles in a cultural way of just going down to the beach, sitting around in a circle, and then me and other police as well, and the chiefs of the Torres Strait Islander Police Liaison Officers in the Outer Islands, working to educate people in Torres Strait about what domestic violence is and obviously coercive control and different types of abuse. And we've had great results in terms of increased reporting earlier, because obviously DV was being reported to us at a real crisis point. But now people obviously know what DV is and can recognize the signs quite early, and then are obviously feel comfortable enough to contact police and report police before it gets to that point again, if I could say that. So it's really building the relationships and working with the communities on the ground, identifying the needs, and then obviously working together to ensure that there is safety. Because really that is our core business for police, obviously, is community safety.
Yeah, community safety and culturally safe approach to policing, I believe. And what are some of the unique challenges you face as an Indigenous police officer, and how do you navigate these challenges?
There are a lot of challenges. Obviously, I'm policing my own people and my own family. As I said before, a lot of First Nations people do not like police, and it's because of colonization, assimilation, and the act that police played in removing our families and removing our kids. So that's something that obviously is still very raw for many First Nations people, including my own family. So a lot, you know, I even have it in my own family where, you know, they ask why I'm doing this job, and I have to deal with family And, you know, I have a job to do, and that's first and foremost, and that's keeping the community safe. And if I have to, you know, do my job, that's what I have to do. If I have to arrest my own family, that's what I have to do. But, it, you know, it does come with a lot of challenges, and, you know, I have to deal with that. I chose this job. I chose to wear this uniform. But I think, you know, the pros, there's pros and cons, and I think it's better me being in the service and wearing this uniform and helping my people, even if that means sometimes I have to arrest them.
Yeah, you're doing your bit to serve your community. But how do you think the police force can better support and empower Indigenous officers like yourself?
We can be utilised in a way that can enhance service delivery. I mean, on our PLOs, on one way, having First Nations officers like myself, well, the work that I'm currently doing in the training spaces is helping to develop and deliver cultural capabilities training. So I've been heavily involved in that since the last year. And so me and a team of other First Nations officers and PLOs. So this is a great way that this service really has empowered us and they've utilised us in a way that is really benefiting the organisation, because through cultural capabilities and educating our colleagues, we are really enhancing and making the service delivery, especially for First Nations people, to be more efficient and effective.
Yeah, and one issue that's recurrent that comes really often in the media, in the reports, in the communities, the over-incarceration of Indigenous people. What role can Indigenous police officers, in your view, play in addressing systemic issues like this one?
I think we've got a... I think we play a big role in playing positive role models. I think if they see me and the others in the series wearing the uniform and working for our people, I think it is a good thing. I think that we can, if we can encourage other younger people to join, that it will benefit our people, not only the service, but it will better our people, because we ourselves as First Nations people and officers, you know, I come from two angles. Like, I'm a police officer and a First Nations woman. So I come with both lenses, and I can use that to my advantage when I'm dealing with my own people. So we have deep understanding of all the social issues. I think we can help to stop young people from offending or DV, and really helping, you know, our family to break the cycle, so to speak, or helping a young person to get out of the cycle of reoffending, because they see they can work with young people and they can see their own doing well in a uniform.
Let's go back to yourself and your involvement in the police and in this documentary. Can you tell us about any program or initiatives you've been involved with that aim to improve police-community relations in First Nations communities?
Like I said earlier, I've been heavily involved in the implementation of cultural capability training that the service has only implemented from the Commission of Inquiry, which is really a step in the right direction, I think, for our organisation. You know, having it co-delivered, co-designed and co-delivered by First Nations people within our organisation is a great initiative, because it's really authentic, and it's really, we've done community consultation from all over the state, from the Torres Strait, Cape, Mount Isa, right down to the Brisbane region. So we really have talked to a lot of people and got a lot of advice and input from elders as well, all the community justice groups from all over Queensland, and really helped to develop a great training package for recruits. And now I'm currently working on this training going statewide. So it's something that I've been heavily involved with, and I help as one of the lead facilitators, and doing a lot of trade telling when I do the training. So I think it is very good training, and I think that it's beneficial, because it can only enhance our service delivery, because all of our officers and sworn and unsworn will have a better understanding of First Nations people. Because let's be quite honest, police come across our people on a daily basis.
And you kind of touched on what I'm going to ask you now, but I'll maybe ask you to elaborate a little bit on that. How do you balance your Indigenous identity and cultural responsibilities with your role as a police officer?
I'm not going to lie. It is very hard. You know, as I said before, I am a First Nations woman, and I'm married to a Torres Strait Islander man. And so there's lots of cultural responsibilities that I need to adhere to on a daily basis, especially when there's sorry business, sad news. I have that cultural knowledge, and I can be culturally sensitive as well as doing my job. So I just think it's about balancing those two, and it's about talking to community and being transparent and really working with community where you can. But it is hard. It's quite a balancing act. But I think, you know, it's all about showing respect. If I show respect, most of the time I get respect back. But, you know, policing is a hard job, and sometimes not everything goes to plan, and it is quite a balancing act for me, yes. But, you know, I think I gained strength and knowledge from my ancestors. You know, they had it way harder than me. They lived under the Aboriginal Protection Act. They had no lives, really. You know, they were controlled. And I'm in this position where I can really be a role model and work with our people.
And what advice would you give to other Indigenous people considering a career in law enforcement?
I would say give it a go. If you've ever been interested, you know, it is a career that's diverse. You know, you can be a detective, you can be water police, you can be dog squad, you can be mounted police. There are just so many options within the police. And I think for our people, you know, there is definitely a place for our people within the service, you know, as sworn or unsworn, as a PLO or as a sworn officer. I think we need more young people to join, because I think we need our own people to police our own people, because they have the understanding. They really do. I would love to see a young Torres Strait Island person come back to Thursday Island and work and police. That would be something really great, and I hope I get to see that one day.
And looking to the future, what changes would you like to see in policing to better serve Indigenous Australians?
We're heading in the right direction, I think. We've started with this cultural capabilities training. I think that it will take generations to come to see really big changes, but I just want to see my people treated fairly. Like anybody else in the community, it shouldn't matter that they're First Nation. You know, we have a duty of care to the community, and our people are part of the community, and they should be treated like anybody else. So hopefully the service delivery will be more effective and efficient, and I think it will be, but I think it's going to take a long time, because as you all know, you know, change is hard and it takes a long time, but I think we're on the right track.
Patricia Pedro, anything you'd like to add to the conversation before I let you go?
Thank you for the opportunity, for letting me be on radio. I'm really looking forward to the series coming out. Being on camera, being followed everywhere, even on the plane and the boat, was a big challenge for me, but I think it was for the greater good. Because everything I do, and I think every other First Nations officer will say this, we not only work for ourselves, we work for our families, we work for our community, and we work for our people. We have an obligation to pass on cultural knowledge. And I'm doing this in a professional capacity. And I hope that more First Nations people join as a result of the series.
Sergeant Patricia Pedro, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about your participation in Our Law, a groundbreaking documentary series which explores the relationship between police and First Nations peoples. It's been really a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
NITV Radio, share our stories on Facebook.
Now, just a reminder, Our Law will premiere, Season 2 will premiere on NITV and SBS on Thursday the 9th of May at 8:30 p.m. Now, if you want to listen to Patricia Pedro's story, you can find it on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We must now step aside for another break, and when we come back, well, we'll look at a new funding initiative to increase First Nations athletes' participation in future Olympic Games. Stay tuned.
Hey guys, Jackie White here, proud Wiradjuri man. You're listening to NITV Radio. Let's go.
Welcome back. Now, Australian Olympic athletes have received a major financial boost ahead of the Paris Games in July. The Australian Olympic Committee has announced three incentives to increase funding for athletes with specific targets for First Nations competitors. Hannah Kwon has the details.
Australia has long been a sporting nation. In fact, it's one of a select group of countries to have competed in every Summer Olympic Games in the modern era. But just 60 First Nations athletes have been part of that Olympic cohort. Among them is Marissa Williamson-Polman, who'll become the first Indigenous woman to represent Australia in boxing at the Paris Olympics.
It doesn't feel real at all. I'm just a regular human being. But I know my community are really proud of me, and that's the cake.
The Australian Institute of Sport has already released a strategy called the Connection to Country Action Plan, which aims to increase opportunities for more Indigenous athletes ahead of the Brisbane Olympics in 2032. Now, the Australian Olympic Committee has announced a new funding scheme, the Australian Olympic Indigenous Athlete Fund, that they hope will support more First Nations competitors to get to future games and succeed. Ian Chesterman is the AOC president.
Towards 2032, we hope to make a real difference and have a really big number of Indigenous athletes competing for this country, their country, in Brisbane in 2032.
Mr. Chesterman says the AOC hopes the fund isn't just for the future. It will also apply to those heading to the Paris Games in July.
We're really delighted to announce today that a grant we made to every Indigenous athlete in the team for Paris who meets the criteria set down by our own Indigenous Advisory Committee. That's a $5,000 grant, and we're hoping that at least 10 athletes will take advantage of that, and hopefully a whole lot more if they get to be on the team in Paris.
The funding scheme is part of a greater push by Olympic organisers to support potential athletes in pursuing their Olympic dreams. Mr. Chesterman says the AOC is also encouraging donations to all athletes via the Australian Sport Foundation's new aspiring Australian Olympic Athlete Fund.
I think it's really important that we at the Australian Olympic Committee open up funding for those athletes who do so well in games and also in the lead up to games at key benchmark events. But what I'm really excited about as well is with our initiative today, other athletes who don't necessarily win medals will also be able to receive donations directly through the Australian Sports Foundation and then to us and back to them, which I'm sure will be a big boost.
That funding boost is being played out on the international stage as well. The World Athletics Organisation broke with a 128-year tradition in April by announcing it would become the first sport to offer $50,000 in prize money for its Olympic champions, starting in Paris this year. The announcement was welcomed by many athletes, but it was also met with sharp criticism from other international sports federations who accused athletics president Sebastian Coe of failing to consult them beforehand. It's also attracted some criticism from the Olympic movement itself. The president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Buck, says that World Athletics should focus its funding on supporting athletes at the other end of the spectrum.
This is not a discussion really about prize money. The prize money in the Olympic Games exists for decades. In 1976, we have received prize money supported by the National Olympic Committee. And in the meantime, this is more or less, common practice among the NOCs. This is not the question in principle. It is a question there of how to support the athletes best, and there everybody has a role to play.
Sebastian Coe has defended the prize money announcement, arguing that World Athletics must take an active role in supporting its athletes' financial well-being. He says athletes have to see a connection between growing their sport and their own well-being and welfare. For Marissa, that is certainly the case. The boxer says there's a stark contrast between the support she has now compared to when she was an Indigenous kid in the foster care system. The 22-year-old knows all eyes will be on her when she gets to Paris, and she is still adjusting to that reality.
I think it might hit me like during the opening ceremony or when I'm about to get punched in the face for my first bout.
Hannah Kwon, SBS News.
NITV Radio. Share our stories on Facebook.
And that is Let's Go by King Stingray. And with this song, we reach the end of today's program. Your next program on NITV Radio is on Wednesday and Friday. We'll be back with more news and stories from right across the country. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Monday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.